This guy pissed off the corporate leaders from first year students. I was amazed at the discussion that went on. It seemed to be way beyond me. I didn't understand what was being said. Well, I think the reason was that there wasn't much any consequence being said. People were just reeling off words. And as the semester progressed, those who appeared to be so knowledgeable at first began gradually to move into the background in terms of having command of information, and others who had been more subdued and quieter came forward, actually. I thought about that from time to time. Watching kids at Goddard, it was the same process. In fact, it moved me one year to give a commencement address entitled Words, 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 where I tried to make the point that a lot of kids came to college who were very articulate, and they could discuss a great range of subjects. But they were just words. They didn't have experience to give meaning, real meaning of the words. Mm-hmm. And that was what I encountered at first at Cornell. Mm-hmm. I was something at a disadvantage. I remember, for example, having a course in French there. And my early experience with French had been very bad. My first year at the Marshfield High School was taught by a very remarkable woman, Bella Saxby. You may have seen her name over there, that plaque in the room at the library. Yes. She was an extraordinary teacher. And she taught us Latin. But she, the next year, the second year, she went somewhere else to teach. She went to Cabot or somewhere else. So we had a young man just out of college come to teach. He couldn't teach Latin, but he had some French. Mm-hmm. So we all took French. Well, his French was abominable. Even we kids knew it wasn't good, because from day to day his pronunciation of words would change greatly, and we didn't know what was what. But we struggled along and picked up French phrases and whatnot and reading. And then 2 years later, I went to God and they picked up French again. And I didn't have too good a teacher, and I was not too serious. My brother was a class student in Palestine. He was released from the Student Army Training Corps that fall. He started and then had to quit school to go into the Army. Yeah. It was then called Student Army Training Corps. He was stationed over in New York State. Well, we would confuse her, but she would say, "Now, Mr. Pitkin," neither one of us would reply, you know. We knew who she was addressing, but we were for that kind of deal. But she was not a very effective teacher. So here I landed in Cornell, having ostensibly had 2 years of French, and took this course, taught by a Frenchman, who really knew the language. But he knew it so well that you really had to be pretty good. So I really suffered a great handicap that day. In addition to that, he gave us a book on French grammar, and along with other books, and he'd tell us to use these, and we would. And then we would refer to he said, "Don't pay attention to that book, that isn't the way it is anyway." Mm-hmm. So those of us who were not very well based in the language had great difficulty. But aside from that, there was no serious handicap. Mm-hmm.
Did you feel more sophisticated after you finished that one semester?
No, I wouldn't say so. As a matter of fact, I never got sophisticated. All the way through college, I always felt that I was just a country kid trying to get along with it. Yeah. Although I enjoyed college, I don't think I had a genuine inferiority complex. I mean, it didn't bother me too much.
And then what happened at UVM? Did you choose a major?
Well, I started out to be a county agricultural major. So I enrolled in agriculture college at Cornell, and I did the same thing at the University of Vermont. Mm-hmm. And it was a good idea for me to transfer, or rather put it the other way. It was fortunate that I really started at Cornell rather than the University of Vermont, because I booked the pattern, the sequences. They had, as you know, they had required courses along the line. You had to take certain courses. Well, having had even just one semester at Cornell had broken that sequence, so that I didn't have to take some of the required courses, because some that I had at Cornell were somewhat similar, and I was free to take other courses. So I was able to have a lot more electives than some of my contemporaries. And so I took a lot of courses in the arts college as well as in the agricultural college. Actually, we tended to put a tremendous amount of emphasis on the biological sciences in agriculture.
And it's not that way now?
I don't know. I suspect there's still a lot of biological science. Matter of fact, the last I knew, for example, the Department of Botany at the university was in the Department of Agriculture.
Why did you want to be a county agricultural officer?
Well, I'd grown up on a farm, and I knew what they did. They were new persons. I can remember the first county agricultural agent we had in Washington County. And I thought he was a great guy. He was, you know, an able chap. Took a very able chap in those days to be a county agricultural agent, because you had to win the confidence of farmers to be effective. They thought to hear these guys come off of some university, they're trying to tell us how to run a farm. And of course, a good agent wouldn't try to do that. He'd just try to hit the farm and look at things a little differently and get all the information. So I thought this was a great deal. But along the way, while I was in college, I got switched over and got interested in education. Again, I suppose this was a kind of family influence, because my family had been involved in concern for education right straight along. So by the fact that my grandfather and my great-grandmother and others had been involved, and my father had been a local school superintendent, which was not a trained superintendent, they didn't have him those days. And on the school board, all my mother had taught school, all my brothers had been in school. I was kind of naturalized, you know, moved toward education. So that's what happened. And, although I graduated in the College of Agriculture, I've done a good bit of work insofar as to do it in education at the university. Went to teaching first year out of college in Plymouth, New Hampshire. And I taught science, mostly science. I taught one course in social studies, social American social problems.
How did you end up in New Hampshire?
Well, of course, I was looking around for jobs. And my oldest brother was a superintendent of schools in New Hampshire this time. And he would put all superintendents around, but he had a brother that was looking for a job. And so I heard of a job in New Hampshire, in Plymouth.
What was that like? Was it a teaching in a one-room schoolhouse?
Oh no, it was a high school.
It was a
high school. Regular a four-year high school. That was a pretty good-sized school. I think we had around offhand, I would say 250 students.
What was that initiation like, being a teacher for the first time?
It had work. I worked with that Dickens that year. I taught physics, chemistry, biology, and this course in, maritime social problems. And I had never had a college course in physics. I had chemistry. And so here I had to work with the Dickens at the keep up in physics. But Helen had it even tougher than I did. She taught in Hinesburg High School the first year. She graduated in agriculture too, the first woman to graduate from agriculture university. And she taught Latin and algebra and English and chemistry. I think she had a class in agriculture. She taught this 6 or 7 periods a day. Besides that, she was assistant principal. And sometimes we had what they call supervising principals then. In some cases, the supervising principal had charge of the one-room school too. So that woman, she was a woman, would go off some days to visit the one-room school, and this left Helen in charge. In addition to that, she coached basketball. I think she coached the girls' team, she coached the boys.
What were American social problems then, Tim? What were what did people discuss?
Oh, we talked about this problem that existed, the problem of employment, of crime, of the whole range of issues that rose, actually. I remember, incidentally, of talking with the registrar, University of Vermont, about a student that might come to university. And I said they had this course in social problems. And he said, well, I'll tell you something, don't call it social problems when you fill out the form. And I said, why? Well, he said, never get by the university senate. He said, just call it civics.
Why not social problems?
Well, because it was a new subject, and it didn't have a respectability, and wasn't hoary with AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
But civics was.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, just call it civics.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was good advice, as a matter of fact. I thought of it lots of times since. It's the name that makes the difference, and not the content that's
mm-hmm.
important.
You mean when you're trying to introduce something new, that it's better to put it in old wineskins and all that now?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have it accepted right off with in certain places.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, if you're dealing with an education student at a university, the most conservative student.
You mean compared to an elementary school?
Oh, yeah, far more conservative.
Why is that?
Why?
Yes.
Well, it's a little hard to know, but I think probably elementary school teachers are closer to their kids than the college teachers are. And of course the tendency has been over the years for college teachers to be somewhat specialized.
Mm-hmm.
And they therefore build up their own special interests, their own fiefdom, as it were, and don't want to get them disturbed. Any innovation is likely to be disturbing to them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember after I'd been out of college quite a while, I was, I think, supervising principal. Well, no, some, I can't say quite where I was. I was teaching, maybe in Hyde Park, Vermont, principal high school up there. Then called the Morrill Central Academy. It was a, had one time in a private school, but had been taken over by the town, serving the public high school. And I remember talking with one of the chaps that I had known at the university, was on the staff. And I told him, gee, I'd kind of like to teach at university. Oh, he said, you wouldn't like it, Pastor. You couldn't stand it. I said, why? He said, well, they don't ever want to make any change.
Mm.
And I hadn't realized this really then. Close enough to what went on, and the faculty appreciate that.
Mm.
But it's certainly true.
Did you get into college teaching eventually, then?
Well, I taught at Goddard. My education experience was in public schools until I went to Goddard in the fall of 1935 to start a junior college for women. And this came about in a curious way. I went to Columbia, got my doctorate, got it, finished up the work in 1932,
mm-hmm.
didn't get the degree actually for the next year, and was right in the middle of the Depression, and we got this job in New Hampshire, at New London, New Hampshire, as headmaster, they didn't call it, of a new high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a new high school because Colby Academy, which had been a co-educational preparatory school, had become first a girls' school and then became Colby Junior College for Women. This meant that the kids in New London had no high school to go to unless they went out of town.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted a new high school. So this is what we have. It wasn't a new building. It was just extended a little bit the elementary school building.
Mm-hmm.
We had a nice little faculty of four of us, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And they had said that they wanted a really progressive school. I discovered that wasn't quite what they meant. But anyway. While I was there, I got to know people at Colby Junior College. I got quite excited about the idea of junior college.
Mm-hmm.
And having seen how this man, Leslie Sawyer, had been able to get the people at Colby Junior Colby Academy to get the school transformed into a junior college, I thought, why didn't they do that at Goddard? Because Goddard had fallen on hard times, as many other
mm-hmm.
private schools have. As a matter of fact, that's how Colby happened to be able to change. Their enrollment dropping off, their income falling, and then it was time to do something. So as I say, Goddard had changed to a girls' school. I hadn't changed the official name, but they called it publicly Goddard School for Girls.
Mm-hmm.
So in the spring of 1935, I decided I'd leave New London because they elected the school board of chapter. So, curious enough, was on the Colby faculty, but was a very conservative person educationally. And I think, I never could work with that guy. So I just said, well, I won't continue here. Then I had to look for a job. So I kept thinking about it. I thought, well, they were made a positive in a junior college at Goddard. And so I came up, coming up home one day, Marshfield, and thought, well, I'll stop in and see one of my former classmates who was then on the board. So I talked to him and asked him if they ever considered having a junior college. Well, as a matter of fact, they had. So they had a study made sometime earlier. It had been recommended that they develop a junior college, but they'd done nothing about it. So the upshot of it was that in, I think it was July that summer, I found a job of being the director of Goddard Junior College. I, again, don't know how naive I was. I just figured all you got to do is let people know you got a junior college and the girls will come in.
But what really happened?
Well, what really happened was that we actually opened with 24 girls. See, the school for girls was still going. Mm-hmm. It just be built on to that. But believe me, I discovered that they didn't come quite that easily.
Mm-hmm.
I finally landed one student. I don't know quite when this was. It was getting along with someone. There was a girl I can see her today. She was a very nice-looking blonde girl who was interested in art. She was from Springfield, Vermont High School. And she had a scholarship at the University of Vermont. The university then, and I think to some extent now, gave a scholarship to the highest-standing girl and the highest-standing boy at the university.
Mm-hmm.
And she had it, the girl. But she, since she didn't do anything in art at the university, she wasn't very excited about going there. So when I talked with her and told her about we were offering art, she decided to come. And then I began, well, what the heck am I going to do if she's the only one who shows up?
Mm-hmm.
But we kept trying, and it turned out that the woman who was principal of the school for girls, a woman named Ann Goose, had a number of fifth-year girls.
Mm-hmm.
It's apparently common in those days for kids to go through high school and then take a fifth year somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
at a preparatory school. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so she had some of those. And by the time we got those and we found some more, we wound up this group of 25. It was an awfully good class. I don't think I ever had any better class. And mostly Vermont girls, not wholly, but mostly Vermont girls.
Mm-hmm. What was the difference then between a junior college and a preparatory? Was it just a higher level? So to speak to
junior him. College, just the first 2 years of college,
I
thought.
I see.
And we still have them. They tended to shift the name in recent years to community college.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just the first 2 years of college.
Did they get a degree, a certain degree?
Well, yeah, they usually gave the associate in arts degree.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be an associate in science.
Mm-hmm.
We gave the associate degree.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. That's how I got into it. And I went to teaching, of course. Like I taught as well as being director.
Mm-hmm.
I taught. I left science field and went to teaching social sciences. Taught history, economics.
Mm-hmm. So then how is it that you became interested in innovative education? You said that at one point you left New Hampshire because the now elected to the school board was so conservative. How is it that you found that you were not in line with that?
Well, I don't know. I suppose, again, it's partly family background. My oldest brother was, I think, had quite an influence on me educationally, and in other ways, too, for that matter. He tended to be looking forward and finding new ways
mm-hmm.
of doing things. Another reason was that you see, I had a somewhat unconventional school career myself, having jumped around a little bit and having been out of school and having skipped grades and that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing. that's one reason, I suppose. Then when I when we got to Hyde Park, Helen and I got married second year out of college, the end of our first year out of college, and we'd taken a job before we married, as a matter of fact, up in Hyde Park.
Mm.
She was going to teach English, and I was the principal and teaching science. And we were much interested there in helping kids get along more successfully, and we discovered that our usual conventional method didn't work so well.
Mm.
So then we began to try to cast around for ways of improving it, and in the following summer, the summer of 1925, I began to go to Columbia Teachers College in the summertime, take summer work. And my oldest brother, Fred, had told me about William Kilpatrick, and so I had read some of Kilpatrick's stuff. I was most impressed by his approach to education. And I also heard about Dewey, because when I went to Teachers College, I took courses where I read some of Dewey. I never took any courses myself. And I studied Kilpatrick. I didn't take any courses in him, curious enough, until quite a lot later when I was good working in. But then I began to see that what other people were doing in other places, what the possibilities were.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept on classical developing.
Mm-hmm. Did you try some of those methods at the junior college that first year?
Well, in a very moderate way. I think it had said we were a moderately progressive conventional school.
That's a lot of adjectives.
Well, yes. By the standards of God at college, we were not terribly. We, were,
mm-hmm.
Well, we did some things which, curious enough, something now called innovative. For example, the reason I'm not sure of, we had outside examiners for the girls when they got around to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
You get some people from around the community to come in and examine them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that's something that's a great idea. I don't think it's a very good idea. So.
Why not?
Because I don't think that they are sufficiently, the people you bring in can be sufficiently familiar with the work that the students have done.
Mm-hmm.
And the effort ought not to be to determine how much they know, this is my own view, but rather the process by which they arrive at what they do know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you see, anybody coming in can, for the most part, only ascertain to a degree what they know about the kinds of questions that are asked.
Then how did Goddard Seminary become Goddard College? I mean, how did the junior college become Goddard College?
Well, at the end of the first year there, Ann Duke decided to get married. And so she left the job as principal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was made the head of the school, I think the college president of the Goddard Seminary, junior college. We reverted to using the term seminary instead of using school for girls, because the corporate name was seminary.
And there were both things happening at the same time, so the junior college and the seminary?
Yeah, the seminary had been going, I mean, they had called the seminary girls, they called it the Goddard School for Girls.
Right.
But officially, the name had not been changed. Right. Legally, it was still Goddard Seminary.
Right.
So when we, in the second year that I was there, we changed the, instead of talking about the Goddard School for Girls and Goddard Junior College, we called it Goddard Seminary and Junior College.
Okay.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Then we began as a faculty to talk about what we could do to improve our own teaching. We had a series of faculty meetings. In addition to that, it became apparent that it was not a good location for the school. The city of Barrie had grown up around it. The buildings were not the great buildings that I remembered as a boy. It had this great five-story main building. It was a great fire hazard, actually. Brick exterior, wooden interior, all the way through. Open stairwells from the top, clear through to the bottom. You stand at the top and spit right down through the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite evident that this was not a really adequate situation. So we began thinking about about moving, and this led us to think, well, if we're going to move, where would we move to, and what kind of a program we really want?
Mm-hmm.
And we brought some new persons on the board of trustees. The chairman of the board was a very conservative lawyer who was a universalist, who'd been governor of the state. But he was interested in Goddard, and he wanted Goddard to mount for something.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very amenable to having moved Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So the faculty spent, I say, quite a lot of time talking about education. We used as the basis of discussion, I think, in the last year with a book called The Conflicting Psychologies of Learning by a chap named Boyd Boda, who was a Deweyite. Although he was not a blind Deweyite, he tended to be critical of some Deweyite positions. But this got us a faculty to thinking about the possibilities. And then we decided, the board decided that we ought to really try and develop a new program and have a college that would really sort of meet the needs of kids in that particular era. So I went around and talked with a lot of people, writers and lawyers and ministers and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the persons I talked with was George Aiken, who was then governor. Well, Helen had known him because she worked for him in the summertime when she was at college, and he ran this nursery down in Putnam. And George was interested in some of our ideas, and so he suggested I talk with Ralph Flanders, who was then the head of the Big Jones and Lampton Machine Tool Company in Springfield, later became the senator. Flanders was interested. I talked with Dorothy Canfield Fisher, Dorothy Thompson. We even got Dorothy Thompson because she had a protege who came to Garden the girl started, and she stayed on for the junior college. Matter of fact, she was over in Paris. And I was talking to the dean down at Swarthmore. Finally, we picked up all these ideas and then had a meeting at Columbia with Dr. Kilpatrick as the chairman. And there we put together the proposal for a new institution. I remember his asking us when we started the discussion, saying, what are the limitations? Are the bars all down, or are there certain limitations? And our reply was, the only limitation is that we don't have any money.
Yeah.
And so then we proceeded and to bring together ideas and formulated a statement for the kind of institution we wanted. It would be an entirely new kind of institution. Well, we said frankly that there were, basically, there were no new ideas. All the ideas had been tried out, but they hadn't been brought together in one institution. So that's how it came about.
Is that an exciting time?
Oh, yeah, very exciting. Yeah, it was.
Mm. Did the people that you started off with as far as your staff, did they mostly stay with you through that process? I find it amazing that people who were in like a conservative institution could move at the same pace that you did at the same time.
Well, they had their choice. When we got around to really make the move and to locate in Plainfield, they could come if they chose. And I should say about half of the faculty came. We had a very remarkable young woman teaching music. She was not just a remarkable musician, but she was extraordinarily competent in getting kids into musical activities, and it turned out pretty well. She came over. We had a teacher of Spanish who came, a young woman from Stowe, as a matter of fact. Her name is Bert. I think Bert still had a business, or did have a business up there. I'm positive. We had a fellow who taught science at Garden. He had taught science with me in Wallington High School earlier.
Mm.
We had a teacher of French who became the director of admissions, Norma de Rio. She came over. So there were quite a few. Oh, and we had a woman who taught physical education. Norma, she came over too. So there was a fair number of them who came over. I'd say roughly half, I guess. Oh, yeah, and we had a teacher of home economics who came over. She was a good one, too.
Had Helen been teaching at the same time?
No, Helen did not teach there. Mm. God, she was coping with three kids then.
Mm.
When we came to Plainfield, he began had to assume a lot of responsibilities. We moved into what's now the president's house,
mm-hmm.
the now called the president's house. We had students living with us then. We had our own three kids. We had students living with us. So she was a kind of a house mother living in us. And she began to be one of the counselors, I think right off. Everybody was a counselor, you know, thought of it.
Hmm. Because that was an important part of the process?
Yeah. Maybe take a deep breath. And then, over the years, she assumed a variety of responsibilities. She ran the infirmary for quite a long time.
Hmm.
She became the person responsible for the upkeep of the gardens and management of those. Because nobody else was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Then she, off and on, she would teach a course or two. Girls would want something in sewing or in household management, something, so she would.
Mm-hmm.